Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In his first volume of new and selected poetry in 12 years, Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems, Billy Collins combines more than 50 new poems with selections from four previous books, Nine Horses, The Trouble with Poetry, Ballistics, and Horoscopes for the Dead. Collins' unmistakable voice, which brings together plain speech with imaginative surprise, is clearly heard on every page, reminding us how he has managed to enrich contemporary poetry and greatly expand its audience. Again, the title of the collection is Aimless Love. It's a pleasure to welcome Billy Collins back to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Good to be with you.
It's always nice to have you here. What is it like to put together a collection such as this, new and selected?
Well, the occasion for a book like this is usually after one has written three or at least three, maybe four books of poetry, and then it seems time to put together new and selected, which is really just a kind of literary way of saying greatest hits. You know, we don't really want to say that because we're not Fleetwood Mac, but and then the selection process begins, and it's pretty clear to me which poems should kind of deserve to be carried forth into a new and selected and which aren't. But there is a sort of nostalgic feeling about leaving some of them behind, like Noah leaving the unicorn behind. Sort of feel that they've been left out, but they have to make these cuts. And we also thought if we had some like 50 new poems, that the new and selected book would be almost would almost contain a fifth book of new poems.
Is there ever a concern that this best of collection fits in with the new stuff, as it were?
Not really, because I think the new stuff is a lot like the old stuff in my case. I mean, I have a fairly consistent voice, which basically means I have a consistent persona that does the talking for me. You know, he's an idealization of who I really am, and it involves a few adjustments to get him activated. But at the same time, he seems to be a very serviceable voice that accommodates most of what I want to say. So I think there's a real consistency readers would find between the poems of 10 years ago and the poems of today, which is to say I'm not developing much, I suppose, but that seems to be the case.
So when it comes to the selection process and deciding what you want in there, I would think it comes to what you're comfortable with, what you yourself like.
It does. I mean, I did I did all the selections pretty much myself. My editor at Random House made some suggestions, which I took. I mean, there's a few couple of poems he didn't want to see left behind, and other ones he did want to see left behind. But it was just a few suggestions, and then he and I sat down for a whole afternoon, really, and put the poems in a kind of order, because there was no need to keep the poems in the order they were in the original books they appeared in, so we could shuffle them around and create interesting juxtapositions and good poems to kind of begin and end each section, that kind of thing. It was very intuitive. It's hard to explain what the principles of organization were, even to ourselves, but it was fun assembling the poems into a book.
But I assume it comes down to knowing it when you hear it and see it, that assembling is right, that the order is right.
Yeah, we would nod across the table at each other if we agreed on a certain sequence of poems. And I don't think we knew what we were nodding about, actually, in a way that we could articulate it. It was very much, as you're suggesting, a feel, you know, just a kind of sense of what poems might follow other poems. And certainly we weren't using some rational principle of organization, like let's put all the nature poems together or poems about mortality together. We were, if anything, keeping poems like that separate.
Do you find yourself, when you come up with themes like that, do they come up very separately, or do you find yourself writing them together?
Well, I never think thematically. I mean, that's more of an afterthought, I think, or a classroom experience when the teacher or the study question asks, you know, what is the theme here? When I'm composing, the last thing on my mind is, what's the theme here? I'm much more involved in writing line by line, just getting the poem moving through itself to some possible ending. But I will say that there are, you know, only a few really major chords in human emotional life and reactions to, I mean, there's love and there's mortality and there's there's reaction to both, like heartbreak and grief and joy. When a poem starts out, it could be, it could be about the stars, or it could be about eating sushi or whatever it is, but the poems tend to, you know, follow this magnetic north as it pulls them in the direction of one of these basic themes. So many of the poems end up being about love or mortality, or I think those are the only two themes I can think of right now.
But do they come out of what is happening in your life, in the sense of if there is a moment of a life happening that brings you into a certain mindset or a certain place?
Well, I think two things combine when a poem starts out. One is that, you know, one is informed by poetry itself, by all the poems I've written and all the poems I've read. And then there is what experience offers, and experience is offering a lot every day. It's just that we often don't pay much attention to it because we're too busy doing something else. So it's a matter of recognizing an opportune moment, and that could be, and it usually is, something that would seem very slight, just like noticing some geese passing overhead or noticing a blind woman stuck on a corner trying to cross the street, just anything really that will start a little poetic ball moving or rolling, and then it's a matter of just seeing where it will go and trying to follow some thread to an ending.
In following that thread and learning where that ending is, the time frame of that, I assume, can be anything.
In terms of
the actual time that it takes.
It could be faster than you think. One thing that I've developed, I guess, or I don't know if I've developed, but I've just got into the habit of trying to finish a poem, all the poems in one sitting. And that could be a short time or it could be several hours. But it's this progress from one thing to another as the poem steps through itself and finds its own stones to step on and then finally seeks out some place to land, a point, you know, an ending where two things come into agreement. One, I don't want to say anymore, and the reader doesn't want to hear anymore. And when I feel that those two things are satisfied, that's the ending of the poem. So driving down through the poem to an ending is usually one rather seamless experience. I just stay with the poem until I get it to the ending. Now, I must, you know, add that there are poems that show little signs of cooperation, little interest in, you know, moving to an ending, and often I lose interest. And so there are many starts that are false starts. They just never get finished.
I can understand how you would know the first of your mission, but how do you know the audience of when they would be all set with it?
the time I guess the trick is that I'm always testing what I write against a stranger's view of what I've just written. So instead of kind of getting lost in the act of self-expression, every few lines I write, I kind of glance back at them from the eyes of a stranger. And so it's important to me and it's become a reflex. It's not something I think about. But as I'm writing, I'm the writer and I'm the reader. I'm the writer, I'm the reader. I keep switching back and forth so that I think I have a pretty clear sense of when the reader is satisfied. I mean, I feel I can represent most readers.
Listeners to this radio station and to this program got to hear you as the fill-in host for Writer's Almanac during the summer for Garrison Keillor. How did that happen?
Well, I was basically asked to take it over for as a summer replacement, and I thought this would be an interesting experiment. I was very surprised to hear that Garrison Keillor would give the reins to anybody, because he's been doing it for something like 17 years,
right.
And as any listener knows, the program is completely kind of synonymous with him and his voice. But he's been very good to me, featuring me on the Writer's Almanac and having me as a guest on Prairie Home Companion. So I certainly, since he asked me, I certainly wanted to do him a favor. So it was interesting. I got to pick the poems, so that one, in that way I was able to put something of my stamp on the program. And I did get to select the kinds of historic moments that I felt like expanding on.
One of the comments that we got a lot from our listeners was that in the beginning you sounded very Keillor-esque, and by the end you had found your own voice. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, the first day I recorded, you know, I used those fateful words, and here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, July, whatever it was. And I just stopped myself and started laughing because it sounded like I was doing a parody of Garrison Keillor.
Yeah.
And in delivering, because the format was completely the same, and in saying, you know, today's the birthday of Edna St. Vincent Millay, I kind of fell into his cadence. And also, I didn't want to, you know, goof it up or anything. I wanted to play it fairly straight. But I think your listeners are quite right. After a while, I came into my own stride. I felt less nervous about it, and I sounded a little bit more like myself toward the end.
Have you been surprised at all, or pleasantly or otherwise, by the reaction and quite frankly, the reach of that module?
Of the Writer's Almanac?
Yes.
Well, I know it has. I mean, like many NPR programs that have a national reach, it's quite amazing. I don't think about it when I'm saying it or when I'm on Prairie Home Companion, but basically you are, or one is, addressing an audience of, you know, 2, 3, or 4 million people, which is quite extraordinary, especially when most poets begin their careers by reading to 13 or 14 people in a church basement. So it's a pretty heady experience when you come to think about it.
Do you think you build a new audience, that people come to you from just that?
Well, I think so. I think there are probably quite a few people who thought, who is this guy? I mean, what happened to Garrison? There are probably some people, in fact, I've heard from a few people who say that they were kind of worried about Garrison. Was he sick? Was he not here? What happened? Did he give up? And so I think a lot of people missed him, but maybe they grew to I was like the substitute teacher, you know, so I think they were probably all glad to have the regular teacher back.
Well, the title of the new and selected poetry collection is Aimless Love. It is published by Random House. Billy Collins, it's always a pleasure to have you on our program. I thank you so much.
Joe, thank you very much for having me on. A pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Again, it's Aimless Love, new and selected poems. It is published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.